Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and The Nation magazine has a special New York City issue out right now, and one of the articles in it by City Limits editor Jared Murphy is called Wanted, a Progressive Mayor. Let's talk about it. Hi, Jared. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
And let's crowdsource a progressive agenda for the next mayor, whoever he or she is. Listeners, if you consider yourself a New York City progressive or liberal, what issues would you put at the top of your list on which to judge the next mayor? 212-433-WNYC. We'll do something similar for conservative voters at a later date. Today, to connect with this Nation magazine special issue, what would be on your progressive agenda checklist for the next mayor of New York? 212-433-WNYC, or post it to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. And first, Jarrett, on some of the history, New York City hasn't elected a Democrat, no less a progressive, as mayor since David Dinkins in 1989. That's 24 years ago. Why not in this famously liberal city where Democratic presidential candidates get 75 or 80% of the vote?
Yeah, it's puzzling. And I think the answer comes down to how you decide you want to analyze history. You know, do you look at the last 20 or 30 years as kind of a seamless garment with a single defining narrative? Or do you look at each election as kind of a battle unto itself? I think if you apply the first analysis, you say, well, what has changed really since John Lindsay was mayor, which was, you know, probably the peak of progressivism in New York City? Obviously, you had the fiscal crisis and some of the effect that had on, you know, elevating Wall Street as a political player. You had demographic changes, the fact that the left liberal coalition in city politics always has a tougher job than their opponents because they have to hold together a much more heterogeneous group. You know, you have the expense of running a campaign in this city, which is very large and has an expensive media market, all those forces.
And also, you have to go to deep-pocketed sources who become your prime constituents.
Right. And if you don't have those sources, then it's more difficult to get your message out. And in addition, you know, people would also, I think, point a finger at progressives themselves for not articulating, a really inclusive agenda for the city. I think in the face of the conservative tide during the Reagan years, progressives split along, you know, what kind of issues to emphasize. Was sort of identity politics more important or economic justice? So that's the sort of narrative story. Then there's the election-by-election fight. And if you look at that, it's actually a bit more of a rosy picture, or at least more promising picture for progressives. You know, you have several of those elections are incumbency re-elections, which are always easier. So you have Mayor Koch, who governed for the most part as a conservative, being re-elected twice. Same with Mayor Bloomberg and Mayor Giuliani once. Other than that, you have, you know, kind of crucial elections in 1977, 93, and 2001, where you had, you know, basically interesting sets of politics at play each time, a lot of it revolving around different kinds of fears. The fear of crime in 1977 when, you know, Ed Koch, a lifelong liberal, campaigned mainly or largely on his support for the death penalty.
And in 93 with Giuliani's election.
And then you obviously had 2001, a different kind of fear, you know, fear of terrorist attack, which was new. If you take that into account and then you look at the last two elections where Mayor Bloomberg's massive financial advantage has to be considered part of the picture, then you have an explanation that really isn't about so much a sort of seismic shift in the city's politics, but in a kind of a tough losing streak for progressives.
On a case-by-case basis. That's a really interesting contrast between those two models. And part of the history you recount in the Bloomberg years is a failure of ethnic coalition politics. You say blacks never rallied behind Fernando Ferrer in 2005. And Latinos weren't galvanized by Bill Thompson in 2009. Why was it so hard, do you think, for the black and Latino Democrats running against Bloomberg, one each respectively, to get a lot of turnout from each other's ethnic basis.
Well, and the problem or that phenomenon goes back at least one race earlier, which is 2001, when because of the racially polarized runoff between Mark Green and Fernando Ferrer, there was trouble holding together the traditional sort of progressive whites, black and Latino coalition. In those subsequent years, 2005 and 2009, I should say, a hefty majority or at least about half of the black and Latino population who voted did support the Democrat, but the numbers weren't at the levels that they traditionally have been and that the progressive side needs to get in order to win. I think the most recent race was a low turnout race to begin with. And I think, Mayor Bloomberg did a good job of reaching out to Latino constituencies. And I think that, because progressives have not mounted a truly broad-based campaign, identity politics inevitably comes into it. And I think the reverse was true in 2005.
Did you see, by the way, the AP analysis yesterday? This is a little off the topic, but that found that in the 2012 election, for the first time, blacks voted at a higher rate than whites in America. In other words, a larger percentage of eligible blacks, despite all the various suppression efforts, in various ways, trying to curtail early voting, voter ID laws, things like that, there was a higher percentage of eligible blacks who actually went to the polls than of eligible whites.
That is fascinating. And I think that's there are several kind of changes going on under the surface, and we'll see how they play out in the mayoral race. For one thing, the city is less African-American than it has been in past decades. And black Americans tend to be traditional supporters of liberal Democrats. The Latino population, which is increasing, is a bit more ideologically diverse. So that might have some effect. In addition, the city is becoming overall less white, but because of immigration and socioeconomic factors, whites in the city, at least at this point, have been more likely to vote. So their numbers at the polls obviously outdo what their numbers are on the census.
Before we get off Bloomberg and look to the future, maybe these various progressives of whatever ethnic background were actually pretty happy with the mayor, who did seem to have an agenda of ending the racial polarization that was one of the worst parts of the Giuliani legacy, and did other things that people found pretty good or as much as, as good as they could expect from a mayor when they actually compared Bloomberg as an individual to Ferrer or Thompson's prospects.
Well, definitely. The mayor certainly attracted some progressive support. And whether that was because the other candidates didn't impress or because he supported issues that were near and dear to hearts, progressives obviously embrace a lot of different issues and everybody has kind of a hierarchy of what's going to motivate them. The mayor's support for gun control and his environmental agenda are very, very appealing to many progressives. I think for others, the sort of lack of attention to economic inequality and other facets of true kind of New Deal progressivism prevent them from attaching that label to the mayor kind of permanently.
Jarrett Murphy, editor of City Limits magazine, who has an article in The Nation magazine special issue on New York City called Wanted, a Progressive Mayor. Let's get some phone calls on the record here about what progressive agenda items people are interested in, and then you'll break down these candidates a little bit. 212-433-WNYC. Crowdsource. You progressive and liberal listeners in the audience, what you would like to see, not who you would like to see, but what you would like to see in the next mayor. 212-433-9692. What policies? Ed in Brooklyn, you're on the air. Hi, Ed.
Yes, good morning, Brian. As a white liberal progressive who's been living in Brooklyn for the last 12 years, I want a mayoral candidate who's going to speak forcefully and strongly against gentrification. I think that's the word that has not dare be spoken over the last decade or so, and it's the reality, especially in Brooklyn. And I think that we need the people who lived here for so many years to benefit from what's happening in Brooklyn with the resurgence of the borough.
Thank you very much. Sally in Soho, you're on the air. Hi, Sally.
Hi. I'm looking for a mayor who will not rezone the city to push out the blacks and, the poor and the middle class.
Sally, thank you. Paul in Manhattan, you're on WNYC.
Yes, good morning, Brian. How are you?
Okay.
The three things I'd like to have the new mayor consider: making real estate taxes more equitable based upon neighborhoods, because they're very inequitable right now and they're not based upon market value. They're based upon rental value of comparable buildings in your neighborhood. The second thing is get rid of the horse-drawn carriages in Central Park. And the third thing would be removing the bike lanes in Manhattan.
Removing the bike lanes in Manhattan. Is that a progressive item?
I think it would be progressive because I think we've gone back thinking that bikes are really the salvation of Manhattan, and it's really not.
Thank you. Nick in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. What's on your list?
Hi, I would love to see the next mayor speak articulately about the value of the arts. There's no one on the national stage or in politics at all really speaking of the value of arts as far as driving our ideas forward as a nation. And I think in New York City would be the ideal place to really start that discussion and really put it forward on the national stage.
Thank you. And Peter in Greenwich Village. Hi, Peter.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Tomorrow at Grace Church, it's going to be a meeting that's going to determine whether the park remains open to the general public. Washington Square Park, a park known for creating perhaps a large part of what we call American culture because it caught people in the embryonic creative stages, is being turned over to a bunch of robber barons and people like Peter Meyer. What's his name? You know, the hamburger guy?
Yeah.
The thing is that.
But is anybody talking about actually closing it off to the public?
No, but they're trying to form a fake conservancy in order to be able to dictate who comes in and what. You know, the parks are a public venue, aren't they?
They are. Peter, thank you very much. So there's a little sampling, totally unscientific sampling, mm-hmm. Jarrett, and you heard what's on the list. A lot of land use.
Yeah, that was interesting. And that's very telling in a couple ways. I think when we look back at Mayor Bloomberg's tenure and size up where he sits on the sort of progressive conservative spectrum, his land use decisions, especially the rezonings, will truly be his most lasting legacy. That was kind of right on target.
You know, when the Community Service Society did a survey recently of New Yorkers in the lower third of income, their number one concern was jobs with upward mobility. Not just jobs, but jobs with upward mobility potential, followed by safe streets. Do you think that would be much different from what you labeled the centrist agenda of Mayor Bloomberg's?
I think the safety issue obviously does cut across, but I think the jobs with upward mobility is where the difference is between what the mayor has produced and what progressive candidates might be asking for. The mayor has pointed with great pride to the number of jobs he's created over the past couple of years, which do outdo what the nation has done. But we've seen report after report indicating that that job creation has largely been on the lower end of the wage scale. We saw the fight over the living wages.
And the upper end of the wage scale.
Right.
Because I think that's the critique, is that he's creating high-tech, very professional engineering jobs and things like that, or working on that sector to plant seeds there, and very low-wage service sector jobs. And there is a whole spate of industries in the middle, not so great. Of course, those are probably the hardest to attract.
Yes, I mean it's not easy to do, but there's also attracting the businesses, and then the argument could be made that it's also about the requirements you place on employers. You know, there was the fight over the Kingsbridge Armory in 2009, living wages there. A lot of the low wage work comes in and obviously operates in the space that we create for them. And I think progressives would argue that you can place, especially in an economy that's generating quite a few low end jobs, you could probably place more aggressive requirements on those employers.
Jarrett Murphy, his article in The Nation, wanted a progressive mayor. And let's compare in rough terms the way the major Democrats are positioning themselves in a progressive political context. You kind of write off Christine Quinn as, quote, Speaker of the City Council who largely cooperated with the centrist Bloomberg administration. Do you want to give us a bill of particulars there? Now that she finally passed a paid sick leave bill, is Quinn really selling out progressives on any specific issues, in your opinion?
Well, I also point out down below that I think some of the verbiage about Speaker Quinn has been exaggerated, that she is a lapdog is not accurate. She has resisted the mayor on several fronts. I think that, the living wage argument that I keep coming back to, her resistance on sick leave obviously has worn down, and there is a compromise that's now been put on the table. And her position on the development fights, I think, remains a real thorn in people's side. But again, as I say about all five leading Democratic candidates, there is progressive DNA there. That's her background. And obviously, if we were having this conversation in any other city in the country, there'd be no question that these were candidates of the left. But it is different here for good reason. And I also point out that, Christine Quinn may not be progressive's first choice in this race, at least at this date. But all the candidates are really still forming the details of their positions on a lot of issues. And, you know, Christine Quinn is clearly being pulled to the left by some of the debates on the inspector general for the NYPD on sick leave. So where she will end up and where the race will end up, I think, remains to be seen. She might be progressives' best hope.
Last week when I moderated an environmental issues mayoral candidates forum, it was only Christine Quinn out of all nine candidates on stage who said Indian Point should be shut down and who was for the 91st Street waste transfer station, which is considered by some progressives anyway to be a sign of economic justice, to put some unwanted facilities.
Right, environmental justice.
Environmental justice is exactly what I meant to say, putting something in that neighborhood. John Liu is positioning himself as the most progressive candidate. He's for an $11.50 minimum wage when others are more around $9. He's for ending stop and frisk, not mending it. He's for ceasing to give tax subsidies to employers, large corporations who say they'll create jobs, rather than looking at it on a case-by-case basis. It often doesn't turn out that way. But he's trying to stake out these most progressive positions, right?
That's correct, yeah. He would be – if you were to place the candidates on a ruler now, I think that the comptroller have to be on the far left.
And so last thing, how do you distinguish between de Blasio and Thompson on the progressive agenda scale? They seem to be both lining up to the left of Quinn – but the right of Liu. Can you distinguish one from another on this scale?
That's difficult at this stage, and I think, you know, that's something we'll have to keep an eye on. I can't distinguish from them. I think that de Blasio has said more with his housing plan than Thompson has, and his position there is, I think, a bit more aggressive. But like you say, it's difficult to distinguish, and they are clearly still finding their place. I was intrigued by Thompson's release earlier this week linking the collapse in Bangladesh with the need to look to the sources of the products we buy and putting some onus on consumers to be advocates for social justice. That was not something I expected from him or really anybody in the mayor's race. So I think people are still finding where they sit relative to one another. And of course, the most important thing is relative to the speaker who is leading the race.
By the way, Henry on our comments page writes, the rent is too damn high. I wonder if there's a mayoral candidate addressing this. And I see Jimmy McMillan from the Rent is Too Damn High party getting back in for 2013. All right, Jarrett, on your way out the door, we noticed on your Twitter avatar that you had long, long hair past your shoulders. Why'd you cut it off?
Well, I was at a park and I noticed a 50-year-old man with a ponytail, and I realized that I did not want to become that guy in 10 years. So I took steps.
Even though you say specifically, I hope we don't lose that character as we rebuild.
I've always got a ponytail on the inside.
There you go. All right. Jarrett Murphy, editor of City Limits, and he wrote an article, Wanted, a progressive mayor in the Special Nation magazine edition on New York City. Thanks a lot, Jarrett.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, from Frank Lloyd Wright's Procrastination to Beethoven's Bathing Regimen, Mason Curry will be here. His new book is called Daily Rituals, How Artists Work. It's about how creative people of all kinds, not just people in the arts, how creative people set routines. Stay with us and call in with yours.